Okay.
And welcome to another podcast with the Humber Justice students. And today with us, we have our special guest, Joe Kudo, from the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police, and Doug Thompson from the Criminal Justice Studies Program, and myself, Steve Duggan. Today, what we're going to be speaking about is really media and how media relates to the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police and really all modern police services, not only in Ontario, but across Canada.
So, Joe, could you just say who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, Joe Kudo, MD, Director of Government Relations and Communications for the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police. The association is really representing senior police leaders in the province, so that would be from the rank of inspector on up to the chief of police or the commissioner of the OPP. And we are the ones who essentially are the management of the police service, responsible for the operational integrity and the delivery of services of our frontline police officers.
Okay. So, in terms of modern policing and social media, how do you think modern police should be reflected in social media? How do you think social media has affected policing in terms of, for instance, investigations?
Well, I think we're in a situation where it's kind of the Wild West, to be honest with you, still in the policing field when it comes to media, and particularly social media. Police are always a little bit behind the times, frankly, when it comes to adopting new technologies, new ways of doing things. And when you look at media, and particularly social media, new media as it used to be called, it's taken us a long time to adapt from a way of looking at information as something that you kept to yourself because you might use it and you didn't want others to have it, to where we are now talking about things like transparency and accountability and building public trust. And there's a real need to build public trust in policing today for various reasons. So when it comes to social media particularly, I think certainly the chiefs are beginning to understand that social media can be a very effective tool to talk directly to the public that they serve. And you don't have to rely on traditional media to deliver your message. In fact, traditional media generally isn't interested in delivering a message that is yours. They're interested in their message. And that sometimes doesn't gel with what the police are trying to do. So in order to reach people out there, people you serve, you have to use the tools. And social media is pretty much the tool of choice, the various social media tools. You mentioned investigations. That's an important area because there's a need to balance information with the respect for individual rights. And we're now starting to teach our frontline officers a lot more than we used to, frankly, in that area, that when you become a police officer, you're not just a law enforcer, you're also a social worker, in a way. You're a community builder. You're somebody who builds partnerships. And that's the way, really, to get at crime prevention, safer communities, healthy communities. And if we can get police officers to think that way, they become more effective police officers.
Do you think that frontline police officers should be actively engaged in social media?
I think to a certain extent. I think you see a lot of them very engaged. The ones who do it very well understand that there's a corporate message. Every organization has a corporate message. Humber has a corporate message, obviously. So you want to maintain the integrity of that. But you also want to give a little bit of latitude to the police officers to engage with their community, the people they're building the relationships with. And the most effective frontline officers who do tweet, for instance, are the ones who have a bit of a personality. But that personality still reflects their organization, their ethos of the organization, what they're trying to communicate.
And what about the corporate profile of the police in terms of social media?
Well, it's as I said, you know, they're not just law enforcers, and this is the problem that you're always going to have this eternal problem that primarily one of your things that you do is to enforce the law. That's what they do. But police officers are now community builders. They should be community builders. We have in this province a model of policing that's fundamentally one of community policing. It's very different in other parts of the world where the police are essentially a standing army for whoever happens to be in power. Here, we try and see ourselves as part of the community. And the Peelian model, of course, that we reflect the British model is that we are simply, our officers are simply part of the community. They are citizens, they're entrusted with certain responsibilities, we train them in certain things. And so they have to reflect the community, have to be the community. And in terms of a corporate profile, a police service that is seen as something other than part of the community, frankly, has failed.
You had mentioned, Joe, it's interesting, and mentioned that the police and social media have been, or are, behind the times. Now, is that because of lack of government funding to police services within the province to enhance their social media skills, or is it the fear of treading into the realm of evidence tampering? And when I say that, is because in the United States recently, if an event happens in the United States, dash camera video is automatically released. If a person's arrested for impaired driving, that person's automatically released and the images aren't blurred or obscured in any way. You can actually see who it is. So in other words, real evidence is being released prior to any court case. Is that one of the fears why Canadian police are sort of leery to get to that extent? Or is it government funding and it's the money situation?
Well, it's always the money. I mean, in every organization, it's always the money. Right. There's no question about it. It's very costly. We're talking about technology here. I mean, you mentioned body-worn cameras, for instance, right? I mean, if we just separate all of the other privacy issues, accountability issues, and all that stuff, and we just focus on the cost, it's not just buying that body-worn camera and outfitting your officers. It's also the recording, the storage, the people in the back rooms who have to work with those in the justice system to deliver that material. How do you redact a video? And that, all those issues. That's very costly. So when you talk about, why are police seemingly you said resistant? I wouldn't say resistant. I think it is a natural inclination in policing to be cautious. And so change, there's two things that police hate. One is the way things are, and change.
Yes.
And that's just a fundamental mindset of policing. Those of us who have worked in policing, either as police officers or in police, and we understand that. So change is difficult, and so police are always very cautious about new things. So when it comes to media and communication, there's always, one, the cost. There's never enough money always to do these things, but there's also the human resource implications, right? You have to make sure you're doing the best with what you have, and they want, oversight bodies want you to do more with what you have, and in fact with less, and that's a problem. Also, policing is very they have a lot of rules and regulations, adequacy standards, and lots of laws, which is right. Policing must have very defined parameters in which officers can work because of the nature of their job. So that's why it's very cautious, and maybe we don't move as quickly, perhaps, as we would like to sometimes, or we should, or the public thinks we should. So there's a natural tendency in adopting sort of new technologies, new ways of doing things. But when it's proven that it's effective, we have a lot of great innovators in policing. And social media, I mean, there are people in this province who have a bit of a following. They're kind of famous. Inspector Chris Brody, for instance, in Toronto, he's got a ton of followers and gets tweeted out by celebrities in the United States once in a while because he's very good at what he does. He didn't just do that on his own. He was created almost.
I see. And with that, talking about followers, sort of as a segue to our next side, are applicants to the police. Who are police services really looking for today? Applications and the type of applicant has changed over the years. Yeah. Surely since when I began policing in 1974, it has changed. Mm-hmm. So who are the police services looking for today?
Well, it's a complex question, but fundamentally, police services have to reflect our communities. I mean, that's the most fundamental answer I can give you. And when you look at police services, you could make an argument that we don't, if you're just looking at demographics. We're still struggling to attract enough women, for instance. I think we're about 20% of police officers being female in this province. And we also struggle with particular groups like the LGBT community, Muslim women, incredibly difficult, frankly, to attract Muslim women, practicing Muslim women who we can identify and put out to the community. Also some racialized groups, it's always difficult. And it kind of comes in cycles, frankly. Right now, we're having a bit of time, and that's related to other things like controversies around public trust, the street checks issue, that type of thing. But police is also, we're competing with other professions. And so when we come to a place like Humber and we say we want your best and brightest, even outside of your criminal justice program, right? They have options, and those options can be a lot easier for them to look at. I've had a lot of students who say, you know, my dream is to become a detective. I would love to be a police detective. And when they hear it takes you on average about 15 years to progress up to the to that rank, they're very discouraged. You mean I have to slug it out on the streets, you know, and deal with all of the not so nice, even directing traffic, writing speeding tickets? I don't want to do that. Well, you have to do that. Just part of the of what you do. So we really have to sell policing as not just a job, because they can find probably a better job that pay more and have a lot less stress, but as a vocation. And I like to talk about vocations if you feel that's what you're called for. If you're called to be a doctor or a nurse or a university professor, that's great. If you're called to be a police officer, seize that and be in it for the long term. Long term may be only 20 years, right, Stephen? I mean, police officers, chiefs of police are generally 30 to 35 years on the job. But a lot of people are changing careers midstream. Is that a bad thing for police? Not necessarily. If you can get 20 years out of somebody and they're really good, and they bring IT skills, business skills, administrative skills, human resource skills, whatever, non-traditional policing stuff, why wouldn't you go for that? So we have to sell that and get as much out of the very best that we can attract. But it's a challenge. It's a real challenge, particularly on the demographics.
Okay.
So just as an aside, do you think, how do you stop things from going wrong on social media in terms of the police? And I'm thinking in particular the G20 and the infamous Officer Bubbles YouTube. Because you want to promote the impact of social media, yeah, but it can go wrong very, very quickly.
Yeah. Well, part of it is the nature of social media, is the beauty of it, is that it can go wrong. It's actually, if you're part of it, it's kind of fun, isn't it? And see, in policing, we hate it when things go wrong. Well, one, it's bad for business, it's bad for our budgets, it's bad for our public trust, all that stuff. But the way I look at it is sort of a half full cup. I mean, you learn from an Officer Bubbles situation. You have to use that as a teachable moment for frontline police officers. You know, if we could control from a corporate perspective all the messaging that goes out, generally you can control 90% of it from corporate headquarters, right? But when the officers are on the street and you're entrusting them with the messaging, you have to trust them. You have to train them, which we do. You have to trust them. You have to teach them when things inevitably go bad. And when there's a saying that I like to say is when you mess up, you should dress up and you should fess up. And own it. You know, the problem with incidents like the Officer Bubble one is we try and explain it away instead of saying, you know what, we made a mistake. That's maybe not the way we'd like to handle those types of incidents, because it's a corporate mentality, right? And a lot of it is illegal, right? You never want to admit things in case you get brought to court, all that kind of stuff, right? But I think if you're going to be engaging on social media, if you're going to be engaging with the public, you have to open yourself up a little bit, and you have to show them that you're human. And when you do mess up, you apologize, but you also keep media and others who criticize you accountable by saying, hey, that kind of criticism, wrong, and you have to engage in the conversation. Last year during Police Week, we put out a hashtag to, to celebrate Police Week, and it was quote-unquote taken over by an advocacy group here in Toronto who had an issue that they really wanted to draw public attention to. And so the media said, oh, your hashtag was taken over, stolen. And I said, I don't own a hashtag. Nobody owns a hashtag. It's supposed to do that. It's supposed to get people into conversation. But we were at fault as well, as when that group tried to engage on social media using the hashtag to talk about an issue that they felt passionate about. The police reaction was, we don't want to talk to you on social media. We don't even want to acknowledge you out there. Well, that's wrong. That's always going to be wrong. At least from a corporate perspective, you should say, hey, you know, we can talk about this. It may not be necessarily through a 140-character tweet, but we want to talk about this.
Do you find that the higher echelons inside the police realize the importance and the difficulties within social media, like the things that you were saying? I'm teaching students, and it's basically a different world, their social media world, and what I experience and what I interact with.
I think it's slowly changing, I have to tell you. At the OACP, we only started really focusing on social media as our way of connecting about 5 years ago. That's not really a long time when you think about it, right? But at that time, there was pretty much no one from a senior rank on Twitter, for instance, right? You found very few chiefs, one or two maybe at that time, who were actually tweeting. When we started tweeting out and certain other chiefs started saying, you know, if this is a way to communicate, I'll do that, all of a sudden there was a comfort factor that, okay, it might be okay, so we're going to test it out. You know, Toronto Police were very much leaders in this field. The OPP have gotten a little bit more into it. But now we have pretty much most chiefs in the province have some sort of presence on social media. Some of them don't tweet. They rely on a corporate account to tweet where they are, what they're doing, what their views are, all that kind of thing. But, very recently, for instance, the chief in Owen Sound, Little Owen Sound, Ontario, started tweeting up as chief of police. And he's a veteran of Toronto Police Service, William Sornberg, who you probably know, Stephen. Here's a guy who's been on forever. Right, and a very gregarious kind of guy, vowed that social media is not for guys like me. Been on 35 years, all that stuff. Suddenly, they have a bit of a strategy in Owen Sound to reach out to the community. Their corporate account is very, very active, positive messaging, engaging messaging. And the chief is starting to say, "Hey, I'm doing this. I'm doing that. I want to hear from you." And it's opened up a whole new world in Owen Sound of people who are, you know, just interested in what it is that you are doing in our police service, right? So I think we're moving towards a understanding that social media is not an enemy, that it's not supposed to be run by lawyers. It's supposed to be run by human beings who are going to fail once in a while, but it's something that you use. It's a tool. So use the tool to help whatever it is that you're doing.
You had mentioned earlier, and we're talking about various challenges and things mm-hmm. like that that you face. Is there a challenge between service-to-service communication? Now, at the OACP, because you're an umbrella or a governing body of police leaders in the province of Ontario, do you find that some services, no names, are really reluctant? No, we're not going down that road because this is the way we do things in this location. Mm-hmm. And their communications between other services may be impacting pro or con against their stance?
I think generally most services are very good at cross-service communications. I mean, just strictly on investigations and joint forces and things of that nature, they already talk to each other. The technology has helped quite a lot. When it comes to media, I think services want to retain a brand, an identity. And I think that's right. If you're the Ontario Provincial Police, you have a certain identity. You're a cross-province organization. You tweet in English and French. If you're Timmins Police Service, it's a very different type of policing, right? Your issues in Timmins, for instance, last year, their biggest issue was wildlife management. And not only were they getting a lot of bear calls, but also lynx and coyotes, just because of whatever, the weather and, you know, more human-animal interaction and stuff. So they were tweeting a lot about that, you know, those kind of safety tips and all that stuff. But they had to, you know, talk to the OPP in the area that are all around them, policing, to make sure that the messaging that they were putting out on wildlife management was the same one corporately the OPP was doing. I don't think you can be in silos anymore. This is just not going to happen in today's world. It doesn't matter. You can be Gananoque Police Service, small service. They're on Twitter. They're not all that active, but for their community, they're putting out stuff that's important to them. How that relates to the bigger picture of, you know, the really important stuff that we're talking about, you know, the post-traumatic stress disorder amongst officers, street checks, the new Police Services Act, all of these big issues that globally we're dealing with, that may not be as important locally at a Gananoque level, for instance, as it might be for the OPP or for our Toronto Police Service or Ottawa Police Service, who have a, you know, a bigger area, more complex organizations. But do they talk to each other? Yeah, they do. They retweet each other. If somebody's doing something really good, we in the OACP have a committee called the OMRON, an Ontario Media Relations Officers Network, that shares best practices, that shares information about what you can release, what you can't release, how you should be dealing with media, all that kind of stuff. So there, you know, all these services are there. You can't force them, but I think by and large that they understand that this is a tool and it's an effective tool. And yeah, I think we've gotten over that hump. 5 years ago, not so much.
Do you think that, there's a thing that I always find interesting, do you think that social media is actually having an effect? Because I can see people saying, oh, this is a really important issue, so I'm going to retweet it, or I'm going to like it on Facebook. And you're saying, well, actually, are you actually going to do anything about whatever the problem is?
Yeah.
Well, I have. I've retweeted it. So, well, that doesn't help much.
Yeah. This is an excellent thing that we struggle with, because police, if we're about community policing, we have to have the community involved in policing. And the problem that I think we have as a society is we tend to sort of cocoon ourselves in our homes. We don't know our neighbors. We go to work and we have our little cubicles, and our interaction is with a small cohort of colleagues. And so, you know, before you had to sort of depend on other people to stay safe, to be healthy, all that kind of stuff. Nowadays, I think we've developed into a bit of a society that's a bit of a cocoon. You know, our kids are useless in terms of facing the problems when they're 19 years old, because mom and dad have been solving their problems all their lives. So I think how it relates to policing and social media and stuff like that is people think that in very small seconds almost. You know, we always talk about, you know, that, you know, 15 minutes of fame. Well, now it's, you know, you're 1 minute of fame because you've retweeted something and then somebody retweeted you, that kind of thing. We need to engage people to, when they see things, information via social media, to say, what can I do with that information outside of social media, right? Like, it's great to retweet and engage and comment and post stuff to your Facebook page or whatever, but what are you doing about it? A perfect example of this is in February, we launched a crime prevention campaign on fraud. And one of our key partners was the Canadian Revenue Agency. And why we did that is because we saw that the CRA was really trying to reach out to people, especially the elderly and vulnerable individuals like new Canadians, to say, listen, when you get a call saying, well, you're going to be arrested if you don't send money right now because your taxes are not due, you have to give them information that they can act. The act is, one, don't give money to these people. Two, report these people. If you don't report to people, they're going to victimize somebody else. That was the message. It was from police, it was from the CRA, it was from other community partners, the Ontario government, everybody. And so we need to use social media for that. We need to use it for action. We need to use it for information exchange. We need to use it for debate. So that democracy, right, our democracy actually works, and that people aren't turned off by our political leaders that we elect with 35% of people actually voting, right? So, I mean, I think police are part of that. I think police, we shouldn't run away from hard issues, Particularly on social media, you don't have to respond to every single person that tweets at you or about you, but you have to respect groups that have issues and are tweeting and are retweeting and are challenging you or asking you for information. Don't just sit there and say, well, our lawyers will look at it and then we'll decide in about 3 days whether or not to respond. That boat's long gone. And we as police, we just have to get our heads around that. We're not.
Yeah. On the one side, thinking about our students, and what happens when people have done stupid tweets mm-hmm. in the past or idiotic Facebook posts, yeah. and they now come to get hired by the police, and that's one thing that ripples through all our students, thinking, yeah. a lot of them say, oh, I'm going to eliminate my entire social media history, and I think no, you shouldn't, because having nothing there is worse than having something there. But then you see reports of people saying, oh, I tweeted something when I was 15, and now it comes back and bites them when they're 25.
Yeah, that's something that we talk a lot about, in particularly on the recruitment side. And our recruiters, they need to understand that this is a new age. Before, Stephen, when you were hired, it was very different. You didn't have a Facebook page, right? You didn't have a Twitter account. You didn't have what I like to call breadcrumbs that can lead you through social media primarily to where you were 10 years ago or whenever. So I always say to students like you, Doug, that you can't hide from your past. If you were 15 and you posted something, you and your buddies at a party drinking alcohol, that's a fact. There's no running away from it. Does that mean that you won't get hired? Well, no, because I think we need to educate our recruiters to ask relevant questions. The question isn't, so you're 15, you were getting drunk with your buddies. Are you still doing that? I mean, that's really what you want to ask, right? You don't care about what you're doing at 15,
yeah.
right? If you're, you know, you tried marijuana at 15 or whatever. What you want to know is who are you hanging out with now? Are you still involved with activities that might jeopardize your career in law enforcement, for instance, right? So you have to have relevant questions. And I have seen recruits who've asked the same question, saying, you know, I'm not proud of what I did when I was 17. I turned my life around. Is that going to come back to bite me in the ass? No, frankly. Generally, recruiters understand that the younger you are, maybe the more interesting your life might have been, but you have to, what is the person now? Who are you involved with now? And so, if I were a student right now, I would volunteer, go look at my Facebook page. Yeah, you're going to find some stuff there. Am I proud of it? No, not necessarily, but I'm not doing that anymore. I have a 21-year-old son, and I remember when he was 16 and, you know, posting stuff, and I'm following him on Facebook just to make sure he's okay. And I said, you know, hey, where were you last night, right? And, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, I was out with my buddies. I said, well, yeah, except what were all those beer bottles in the background of that Facebook? Oh gosh, right? Like, I'm embarrassed. So what, you're 15 and, you know. But I think you shouldn't stress out about that stuff. That would be my message to the students, right? Just be yourself. Bring what you have to the table now and what you can potentially bring to the future. And the students we have here at Humber and other institutions, they bring not just their, you know, their personal background, but all kinds of volunteer and interesting side notes, that, you know, things that they're doing. So emphasize that to kind of cover up what you may have not be so proud of in your past.
What are some of the, just building on what Doug said then, and on the same vein, so what are some of the key skills or attributes should our students really be concentrating on? Like, what would the chiefs like to see them come forward with?
It's a question that I think chiefs are still struggling with. And I'll tell you that right now, the province of Ontario is looking to change the basic requirements for a constable, where right now, if you have a high school degree and you're 18 years of age and a Canadian citizen, you can apply and become a police officer. The reality is most 18-year-olds out of high school aren't equipped to be police officers. And that's frankly frightening to a lot of these chiefs who were 18 and right out of high school when they were hired 30 years ago. But most of them understand now that essentially what we're looking for, and I always tell my students this, the first thing out of my mouth for every course I teach is, we can teach you to be cops. What we want you to be first and foremost is a critical thinker. critical thinking is the ingredient that is missing in a lot of things that we do in law enforcement, where it's a reactive thing. We react to a crime, for instance, right? We react to a problem, to a situation. And that's important. You don't want to take away that reaction. But what you want people to do is get into the habit of critically thinking through an issue. And so if you're a student at Humber and critical in the criminal justice system courses, what we want to see you coming out of this program is the ability to think your way through any problem, right? So I've had chiefs say to me, listen, I would dearly love to hire people who have degrees in IT. I would love to hire people who have business degrees, law degrees, all kinds of degrees, because I can teach those guys how to drive a car, how to shoot a gun, how to defend themselves hand-to-hand kind of thing. But we can't teach them is how to think. So that's the job that we have, I think, as academics and then teachers and instructors, is to develop their critical thinking abilities and also provide them with the basic knowledge that they can build on as recruits. Like I said, we'll send them to the police college in Elmer. We'll teach them how to drive a car. That's not a problem. But don't give us somebody whose first reaction is pull a gun on somebody who has mental health issues, for instance, right? That's not what we need you to do. We need you to critically think. And that's where a lot of our failures right now is that we don't do the critical thinking part. We are still reactive as a sector.
So basically you're saying that the police force in 10 years' time is going to be a very, very different structure to what it was 20 years ago?
Oh, well, yeah, because right now our police services are radically different, most of them, than they were 10 years ago, I can tell you. I mean, you may not see that necessarily if you just read the Toronto Star, for instance, right? You may think that they're still, you know, back in the good old days or whatever, run by the good old boys. But, you know, the OACP last year had its first female president, Chief Jennifer Evans from Peel Region. We have on our board the Chief from Toronto, who is a black man, right? I mean, these are just markers for me of the changing environment, right? We have an openly gay chief of police in this province. That would never have been possible, even 10 years ago. 10 years from now, I think what you're going to find is the recruits of today, or who have been hired in, say, in the last 5 or 10 years, will then be at 15 years or 20 years in. They will be more of the critical thinking type. And you will have them in, hopefully, senior positions where they are influencing the recruits that are coming in now and in the next few years to be those kinds of critical thinkers who don't see people as a label, a black man, a female Asian, a white person in a wheelchair, those types of labels that we try and put, and then we attach certain things to those types of people. No, we want to see people as people who are just like us, or our neighbors, or our friends, or our families. And so how would you react if that was your family, your friend, your neighbor? And you have to start thinking about this. And it goes against the grain, right, Stephen? You probably never talked about this when you first got hired on, right? It goes kind of against the grain, and it's a cultural issue within a police culture that is very entrenched. I always say, honor the culture, where you've come from, and the good aspects of it, because there's a lot of good stuff in police culture about honor and duty, service, but also understand that the world today is very different. It has 21st century problems that the police have to be a part of. We don't have a choice here. We have to be part of the solution. Otherwise, what we're going to do is we're going to have, you know, segments of our society, of our communities, who are not going to be engaged, don't feel like they're represented, don't feel that they're respected, and therefore we're going to have those problems, right? The problems of mistrust and disengagement, and then we have the violence and all the other stuff that comes along with that.
So, again, I'm just thinking from what you said there, one of the possible amendments for the Police Services Act is allowing a police services board to have a little bit more operational control. And what I'm speaking about is what has been reported in the recently in the media is the fact that the Durham board wants to have more authority and is lobbying the government to have more operational control with the police service, which goes contrary to the present act. Do you think this will come? Do you think that the police services board will have more operational control and can dictate to the chief or the commissioner, this is the way you're going to do it?
I think it's how you define it. There are various opinions even within police governance bodies about what exactly does it mean to have more say. There was a report following the G20 in Toronto from Justice Morton that a lot of people take bits and pieces from and sort of quote and say, you see, the Learning of Justice wants the civilian oversight to have more direct control about police operations. I think where the justice was coming from was police services can't abdicate their responsibility to ask good questions of the chief of police, the commissioner of the OPP, about why is it that we are doing things a certain way or why our policies are a certain way. That is their role. That's what civilian oversight is all about. It's asking questions and keeping these people that you hire to run your police service accountable. I think we're all on the same side there. I think where we get into a bit of a fuzziness is there are some people, primarily mayors and elected municipal officials, who believe that they can run a police service because they've run other things like used car lots or whatever. And so they think, well, you know, I'm elected. I, therefore, the taxpayers have entrusted me with this, and I'm just going to tell you because I tell the Parks and Rec director or manager how, you know, where the grass should be cut. Policing is different. If we are going to what I call an Americanized system where a mayor can hire and fire a chief of police or the minister of community safety can hire and fire the OPP commissioner because, frankly, I don't like the way you police or your views, or frankly, I just want my buddy to be the chief of police. And this happens in the United States quite a bit. Our system is different here. We have a separation of the governance versus operational because we don't want politicians to say, we are going to put more police resources in that community just because the mayor says so. Right, this community here where the mayor, the councilor in the area is not the mayor's buddy, doesn't get as much. That would be very, very dangerous, I think. It would be counter to community policing where everyone should be treated equally and with respect. So a lot of this, Stephen, is also, it's just money. We started off the conversation by saying, you know, it's always a money issue. Of course it's a money issue. And essentially, police service boards want to be more controlling of their budgets. And that's not a bad thing. We understand this. But their fight isn't necessarily with their senior managers in terms of the police service. It's more with those who actually allocate the funding, the province in this case. And we have a system where property taxes are funding policing. There is a debate about whether or not that, in fact, should be the way we fund police services. I think that's very accurate and very important to have that discussion. So what they're asking for instance, is they want the province to intervene on the arbitration of police contracts. Okay, well, that's an employer-employee argument. The employer is the police service board. The employee is the police union. The chief of police is in the middle. They are neither. And so for you to be criticizing the police chief for not controlling their budget when the downloading from the province is astounding, the training requirements by the province continue to go up, and there's no extra money, it's very difficult. But the conversation is going to continue. I think that is probably one of the big challenges for police leaders in this province, no doubt.
For the next 5 to 15 years, what do you think is the most important factor the government should be providing for the Ontario Police Services? What do you think they should be concentrating on?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is obviously there's a debate about what is policing, what are the core police functions that we need to have our paid police officers do. There's a debate about whether or not paid police officers should, for instance, be providing security at construction sites. Those are paid dues. This is a big area of debate right now. So the costs things, the implications of the costs are going to be very, very important. And there's no easy solution to that, I think. Policing is going to continue to be very expensive because, one, it's a human resource intensive, and two, it's technology intensive. Body-worn cameras are coming. Tasers are already here, except, ironically, in the city of Toronto. These are all very expensive technology toys, as we like to call them, right? So we're going to have to find a way to try and control those costs. And probably the way we're going to do it is by policing smarter. And that's really where we're going with, I think, policing in this province, is what is it that we want our officers to do and how do we want them to do it? So when we train our officers, we need to train them in a way that they're just not law enforcement officers. They are, in fact, social workers. We have become the de facto first responders to everything. It's not the firefighters, it's not the paramedics, it's not the social workers, because they don't work 24/7 like we do. It's always the police. When you call 911, who shows up? The police first. And then there's a tiered response. That's not going to change. And we have a real, I think, challenge, particularly in areas, for instance, like mental health issues, where I've always believed that if the police officer is the first responder to a mental health incident, as a society, we fail. We fail that person because 15 years ago, the government of Ontario made significant cuts to social support systems for people with mental health issues. We deinstitutionalized folks who may, frankly, need a little bit of help in that area. And we are now reaping what we sowed. And the police are on the front line of that because the police can't simply say, we're not coming. If we don't come, who's going to come, right? And you have this. I mean, we've had incidents where people have been, unfortunately, shot by police, where if they'd had these social supports, the programs, the medical attention, all of that stuff, they may not have been in that situation. And if a police officer shows up, they have, you know, use of force options that you don't want to see them use, but they're trying to use them if a situation calls for it. Where's the discussion on that, right? These are hard discussions, and the politicians have got to take some ownership of this. This is not a Ministry of Community Safety and Correctional Services issue. This is a Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care issue. Where is that ministry in all this? They don't want any part of it because, you know what? It's hard. It's politically, it's very dangerous. It's complicated. And so what we keep doing is we keep throwing police officers at issues where they really don't have any business in. Now, the flip side of that is we put police officers in as social workers, for instance, as school resource officers in schools, where it's great, you know, the soccer mom and the hockey dad love it, but should you be using police officers to do that? There's a lot of good that comes from that if you're willing to pay for it.
Is there a danger in, because I was seeing the one aspect, giving the police more and more and more roles, and I see occasionally the police officers, I just think of their duty belts, and there's more and more and more things on their belts, and eventually it's like
you can't walk.
You can't walk because you're expected to do everything, so you're trained badly at lots of things rather than well at a few things.
And I mean, there's a debate about specialization. Should you specialize in policing? Part of that is if you do, does that close doors later on for you, right? You want police officers to be able to do, you know, traffic and eventually do homicide or drugs and, you know, all that stuff. But are we asking too much of them? And that's a really good question because essentially what we're finding is that police officers are responding not just as law enforcers, but as social workers, healthcare workers, you know, they're picking up the garbage, you know, kind of thing. And so what are we asking the police officers to do? And see, this is a debate in the Police Services Act that probably will be passed sometime in 2017 in this province, a new Police Service Act. What do you want police officers to do? Because that'll drive then, if you want them to do that, you have to be able to pay them. And if you don't want to pay, then they can't do. So we have to cut certain things. And, you know, do we civilianize things? Well, there's a lot of civilianization. I mean, there are very few police services in this province, except maybe the smaller ones, that don't have a civilian communications manager, director. And that used to be done by a police officer who was probably not trained, probably hated the media, and probably did it fairly badly, unless you were somebody who was gregarious and, you know, outgoing or whatever. But we've done that. Finances. Why would you pay a police officer to oversee admin stuff? Well, you can have somebody who's in charge of it, but underneath them, they're all civilians. right? Our communication staff, they're all civilians. So that's where we're going with that. It's cheaper. I'd say it's more effective. They're better trained. Yeah. They stay longer because police officer, if you're in 4 years in traffic, well, you want out, right? You want to go and do something else and pad your resume so you can become chief someday, right? So I think that those are the kind of conversations we're going to have. But fundamentally, though, it's what do you want them to do? And more critically, is what do people want police officers to do? You know, do you want them? Do you want them to be first responders?
Yeah. So in closing, and this is what we ask everyone, what advice would you give our students in police foundations and criminal justice in order if they want to go into policing? What advice would you give them for what they should be doing now?
Well, first and foremost is what I always say, and I said it in this interview, is be a critical thinker. It doesn't matter, you know, what your intelligence level is, what your skills are. You want to position yourself as a critical thinker. If you do that, you will be an attractive candidate for whatever you want to do, including policing. Do that. Also, understand what you're getting into. I think a lot of students, they get into police foundations or criminal justice and thinking it's, you know, it's glamorous and golden and wonderful. It's hard work. It still is a hard work thing. It's not for everybody. And be flexible so that if it's not for you, you can still take what you learn in criminal justice, for instance, or police foundations, and use it to whatever it is that you're going to wind up doing. I'd love to see nurses in the province have a criminal justice background. Wouldn't that be awesome when they're dealing with, you know, somebody, police officer bringing in somebody into a hospital that you know how police think, for instance, right? A lawyer, a doctor, anybody, right? So there's nothing wrong with getting good, solid education, experience, meeting new people, trying stuff out. You don't have to be a police officer only. You can be a civilian in a police service. You can be in border security. You can be in parole. I mean, there's all kinds of things in criminal justice. So don't just be so myopic that you focus on, I'm going to be this and only this, and then if you're disappointed because you don't reach that goal, you wind up doing nothing. And that's the worst thing that could possibly happen to a student.
Great. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Excellent.
Thank you.